I'm Bill Teeple, and I'm here with Alan Cobb and Donna Colby, and this is Icon Art Radio. Well, in our last show, we somehow, towards the end, got to the point where we were discussing all of life and moving through life as a work of art, and our actions as strokes on the canvas, and the drama of that. And Alan was exploring that territory. Would you like to take the ball from here?
Sure. I'm not quite sure how much further I can take it, but the basic idea is sort of related to the indelibility of action. Once you've performed an action, it's performed and you can't take it back. And so in a sense, everything that we're doing is analogous to what Richard Beamer was talking about 2 weeks ago in terms of oil painting, that, you know, as you paint, you're putting marks down and you can't take them back up again. And so you're living dangerously as you paint, and it's an exciting moment of truth with each brush stroke. But in a sense, we're doing that with everything that we do. We're painting on the canvas of time, and each one of those actions is as indelible as a splotch of oil paint on a canvas. And I guess there are ways of accommodating the indelibility of it, or neutralizing the effect that we've just created, or overshadowing the effect that we've just created. But that whole model is, in a sense, a way of looking at life backwards. You sort of have to be looking at what you just did all the time to be dealing with anything that I just mentioned. And it seems like the real trick is to be looking forward all the time and not worrying too much about where you just came from. But that suggests that you wouldn't learn from the past, and so that's another paradox, and I'm not sure where it leads.
Well, the analogy with art is that, and with the understanding that we can't live for the fruit of our action, only for the quality of the action itself, is that we can only be responsible for the placement of that stroke and the degree of precision and knowledge that's contained in that stroke. And then sometimes it has a better effect than other times. And to always be going back and worrying about, how we can fix something that's happened that we can't fix, then you're stuck. But a lot of people, I think, go forward, damn the torpedoes, and they're not, in life, I think we find a lot of people don't realize that every action that they make, even thought, word, and action, does have consequences.
Yeah.
And I think as we mature, one of the things we understand is that everything we've done has consequences, and that what we're living today are the consequences of our actions.
Right.
And yet we can't live for, hoping that the benefit of what I'm doing today will deliver later, because we have no control over that. But we do have control over the precision, and how much knowledge and intelligence we can bring into each stroke we make.
Well, and it also relates to the story that Alan told in the last show about the drawings that they were supposed to destroy in this class, and how some people were very attached to, it was very difficult for them to let go of those works because they thought they were good. And in this context we're talking about today, there's certain actions that we do, experiences that we have, that we want to hang on to.
Go ahead.
Pay no attention to the man with the bell.
And there are
other experiences
that we really just wish didn't happen.
Icon Reality Radio.
Can I say that on the radio?
No, I don't think you can.
Yeah, it's.
I'll have to change it to Fruge.
Anyway, there's certain actions, there's certain things that we do and experiences we have that we wish would last forever, or at least last a little bit longer than they do, and other actions that we just are highly embarrassed by and wish they never happened, and we want to redeem ourselves. But in both cases, it's the same state we place ourselves in of putting an overlay on the present experience.
Right.
And it can be a positive overlay or a negative overlay, but it's still fogging up what we're experiencing then right now.
Right.
Innocently. And yet, even though that may be something that we aspire to just live very innocently and freshly in every present moment, if we start putting that on as a desire, like, okay, from now on, I'm going to live fully in the present moment, then that can become an overlay where every time we're doing something, we're at the same time watching ourselves. Am I fully present? Am I not? You know, and that's an overlay too. So, I think the old Buddhist phrase of chop wood, carry water is sort of, it represents that state where we're just doing life as it's happening in the moment. We're not thinking about whether we're in the present moment or not. We're not dwelling on whether we are doing something well or doing something poorly. But all of those characteristics of life, whether I'm chopping the wood well or not, it's just sort of built into the naturalness of the moment if we're just there chopping the wood
and responding innocently to what comes.
Yes. Yeah. And the real delicacy of it is that sometimes what comes is a thought about what you did. And that can be experienced just as innocently as mm-hmm. not thinking mm-hmm. about what you did. It's a question of whether you are summoning the thoughts or experiencing them intimately, and it's the same mechanism on a very, very intimate level.
Yeah, which goes back to what you were saying before about learning from the past and connection. You know, we do have a past, and we do learn from our past and the past. It's fun to read art history. We're always talking on this radio show about something that a great artist said or a way that a great artist worked, and that feeds us. It nourishes us to think about those things and to be aware of those things from the past. So being in the present moment fully doesn't mean negating the past.
Well, what is in the present?
Exactly. I mean,
the present. What is the present? It is this triumvirate of the past and the future and the now. Mm-hmm. And it's made up. This moment, we would be completely nowhere, which is the only where, but we would be in that unable to reflect on its state if we couldn't contain it, hold in our minds, or whatever we are, at the same time, this past and this concept of the future, this projecting into the future to move forward into, and we're always in the now doing this. Mm. So I think the difference is like whether we're artificially like pulling the past on, I mean, thinking about it too. What we're talking about is this overlay, this thing of the riding a horse on top of a horse, mm-hmm. whatever you said.
Right, yeah.
Instead
yeah,
of just, there's the innocent flow of attention, and the name of it is what of this thing that's going on, is what we just described, and it flows. And we can innocently be it and do it as fully as we can, with as much of awakeness in the process, or we can get all convoluted and twisted. You know, I mean, and that's just as natural. I mean, this get convoluted and twisted and all weird and acting like an idiot is natural also. That happens all the time. It's just part of the story. It's more comfortable to be in the flow, free flow, and to be unattached and to just dig it. So, you know, get down, dig it.
Yeah, wasn't it Lord Buckley who said, dig infinity? Talking about the NAS.
Well, it's, I think that's one reason why people enjoy watching movies. Mm-hmm. Because when you're watching a movie, you can be fully engaged with the emotions of the movie, no matter what it is, fear, sadness, high suspense, bliss, whatever. And yet there's enough detachment there that...
it's safe.
It's, yeah, we feel secure in experiencing those emotions. Occasionally we'll watch a movie, though, that hits too close to our own personal experience, and then we leave the movie theater very overshadowed by those emotions because they've blended with something that caused us pain or fear or whatever. But it gives us a taste, I think, that experience of witnessing in the sense of watching a film, it kind of gives us a taste of what our lives could be like if we could allow the story to play itself out as it is naturally doing, with its ups and downs and ins and outs and all its convoluted things, and just be there, going through it like we do when we're watching a movie.
But, well, I think as we evolve, the experience is more of that you're watching a movie.
Right.
And that you're almost like dreaming. You're this detached state of awareness dreaming this thing. Well, not the dream state, I won't get confused, but there is a sort of detached, like you're watching a movie.
Well, and it's like what you were talking about before, when you're actually living that way, you're much more fully engaged with every emotion and feeling and perception, and it's richer and more vibrant. So it's this, the non-involvement is not the same as spaciness, for example.
Not as much as what?
Not the same as being just spaced out.
Well, but there's not so much identifying with the emotions and all. You're more like witnessing
right.
the emotions as separate from yourself, doing their thing. You know, this happens, and then there's a reaction, and you're witnessing these forces at play.
Mm. It's really, in a sense, on the level of discrimination. It's in understanding that the thoughts and feelings that fill the mind are thoughts and feelings filling a mind, and you are not the mind or the thoughts and the feelings. But if that's a concept, then it's another overlay that has nothing to do with the reality.
Right.
The concept that you are not your not the mind is just another concept, and we have an infinite supply of those, and the mind generates them whenever there seems to be any lack of them in the things that are happening to us.
But I will go to war for that concept. I believe in it.
Yeah, it's a good concept for killing people over. Mm. So it's a funny thing what it comes down to is that we're using the facilities of the mind to try and find out what else there is, and the facilities of the mind can't ever tell us what else there is. They can kind of point at it, build models of it, and suggest analogies to it, and hear people describing things and build more models and analogies. But it's still all within the mind. There isn't anything conceptual that doesn't happen inside the mind. And that which is experiencing those concepts is not inside the mind. Otherwise it wouldn't be looking at the mind. So it's doomed if you're trying to deal with it on a conceptual basis, which is not to say it's not worthwhile to deal with it on a conceptual basis at least long enough to discover that that's not going to get you there.
Which is why we need poets.
Yeah.
Because poets use words and sentences to go beyond concept.
Yeah.
And to
boldly go.
Awaken us to something we couldn't, you know, and which is, I remember being at a point when I first started reading poetry where I thought I was supposed to understand it the same way I understood a textbook.
Mm.
And it baffled me and frustrated me because I would read a poem and I wouldn't know what the poet meant until there really was an aha experience at a certain point. I don't remember which poem it was, but I remember reading a poem and having that inner experience of going beyond obvious meaning to something that the poem was pointing to. And even though I couldn't express what that was, it was tremendously fulfilling and boundary breaking and wonderful. And it made me fall in love with poetry at that moment, even though I couldn't have told anybody exactly why I had fallen in love with poetry. It was just some innocent experience that went beyond meaning and logic.
Which is, I guess, why I write poetry, but why I also compose sound sculptures, because they go beyond the structure of music.
I think we're, you know, we've gotten pretty abstract here and a little bit away from
our usual
discussion.
The last few shows started out pretty abstract.
but I think that actually we're hitting a very significant point, because if we're making art, I mean, if art is about what we're discussing, then it's on track. If it's about anything else, it's off.
And as you were pointing that out, I couldn't help thinking of that matchbook cover that says, "Learn to draw." Where does that figure in? I want to learn to draw. It's nice to be able to draw. It's handy and fun, and it can lead to art.
Well, there's a lot of anxiety about producing art.
Oh, this is what I'm glad you're going to take it further, because this is the point I'm trying to make. It's almost all dross. It's almost all convoluted. It's almost all not doing what we've been talking about doing and performing life innocently. It's almost all that. Mm. And yet the initial impulse and where the greats come from, the great poets that say it in this subtle way, they're doing it, but the rest is almost all a little bit off.
Well, where I was going with that,
about
there's a lot of anxiety to producing art. When I was in art school at RISD, everything had to be cutting edge, original, in a certain way that was popular back in the 60s. You know, there was a certain flavor that your art kind of had to have if you were respected at RISD. And to get by and not be horribly criticized in class, I put on that mantle and painted that way. But when I was home doing my own little for fun things, I was drawing these little, it turned into a set of cards that some people I knew who had a printing press produced. They were little drawings of children doing little activities, you know, and they were very figurative, illustrative, and I felt guilty doing those drawings because it wasn't, quote, real art as defined by RISD. It was just my little play. But at a certain point, somebody who I very much respected looked at this whole body of drawings and said, "There's so much silence in these." And it opened my eyes to some inner value that was very natural in me that was spontaneously coming out in these drawings that I didn't even see myself because I was so prejudiced about what real art actually was. To me, these were not really worthy examples of art because they were just my cute little drawings. And yet something that was fully, deeply at my core was coming out in those drawings and not in the drawings that I, not in the paintings that I was doing to please the professors and be far out and cutting edge hip artist.
And probably the most, I mean, and these drawings that you did that were from your heart would be the most original. Mm-hmm. The other, probably everybody was making the same stuff that you thought was supposed to be the way it's supposed to, I mean, was original art. And yet it was totally unoriginal. It was just a cookie-cutter modernism. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had the same experience in poetry writing in college, that there happened to be a small clique of really hardcore poets whose approach and attitude was heavily endorsed by the professor who was responsible for most of the poetry writing programs. And so if you didn't generate stuff like they did, and if you didn't have the same attitude towards it that they did, like, for example, if you wrote poems that just had a lot of fun with words, then that was just wordplay. It wasn't real poetry. And real poetry had to have a certain dry, impenetrable quality about it that left you wondering what on earth strange, subtle, you know, sliver of meaning was being, you know, conveyed. And there was one particular poet who came to visit the college by the name of Starbuck. It was a perfectly acceptable poet, and I mean him no ill will. But there was something about his writing style that got adopted by the clique. And so it became, from my perspective, kind of a satire on Starbuck. And these people were imitating him and writing these. One of his books is called Bone Thoughts, which I think nicely evokes the place that he's coming from. But all, you know, these three or four other college students who, you know, were trying to come from the same place instead of coming from wherever they actually were, they made it so impossible for me to have any audience for my poetry that I just stopped entirely. And I didn't start writing poetry again until I got out of college. It was a completely stultifying environment for being creative, because you were really being taught to be imitative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's the same thing that happened to me with my art.
Well, this is the common experience that school will do. Because every person that walks through the door, my feeling is everybody that walks through the door and decides they want to express themselves visually, and I can help them with that, has something to say about their visual world. And they can say it more awkwardly, and they can say it more professionally. But if they say it at all, then there's something to be gained and gleaned and gotten from that person. So we all should be hungry to get at the heart, I mean, get at each person's heart, each other's hearts. But this thing of the competitive nature of it, and that there's a king of a mountain game going on here, that's what's always bothered me about the art world. And the school system feeds right into it. They cull out everybody except for those that look like they might win.
Right.
And the others, you know, they're helping them to not, you know, have to go through the suffering of being defeated later.
Right. It's
such a common thing, because the people that often go on to really change the art world are those who stay with their guns. They know inside that this innocent thing they want to do, even though it's not of the order of the day, is valuable. Right. Most people don't stay with it. Cezanne is our answer of the person. I mean, it's our example of the person that did that.
Yeah.
They don't stick with it because they're told all along that you can't do that.
Right.
And so they just give up. But a few people stay with it. Or a few people go through the other thing, come out the other side and realize they're doing cookie cutter postmodernism. And they say, hey, that's not me. And they find themselves about 10 or 20 years on in their career. And then they do something personal.
And then they get heavily criticized, especially if they've gotten famous in the process. And then everyone goes, what in the world are you doing?
You should stick with what you were doing before.
I think a contemporary example of somebody who stuck with her original vision and it was marvelous was Elizabeth Peyton. The painter Elizabeth Peyton, who decided she really liked doing portraits. And she even liked doing portraits of famous people, like Princess Di, you know, or a rock star, or, you know, some Shakespeare or something like that. And she would do these wonderful portraits of, and then all of her friends. And she was told by many people that, you're never going to make it as an artist. She was in New York, you know, you're never going to make it as an artist doing portraits. You need to change and do something else. And she just said, this is what I love to do, and kept on doing it. And her works are wonderful. I don't know how famous she is.
She's pretty famous.
But she definitely captivated people's interest because they could see that there was this vitality and freshness and truth in her paintings.
I think we need all the examples we could possibly get of people who have done great work, who were told at the beginnings of their careers how pointless it would be for them to continue what they were doing.
Yeah.
Dave Brubeck was told, you know, in no uncertain terms by his music professor at, I think it was at UCLA or USC, I'm not sure, where that, you know, he had a good sense of, you know, what to do with the piano, but he obviously didn't have the manual skills to become a great pianist, and he didn't have enough insight into music to be able to play the piano expressively, and he should look for a different form of self-expression. And, you know, and so you have Dave Brubeck, whose music is stunning and totally individual because he didn't learn any of it from these people.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.